Ritter Sports Performance Podcast, where we discuss coaching and training for athletic development and sports performance. I'm Chris Ritter, head coach and owner of Ritter SP. Thanks for joining us. Whether you're listening for yourself or to help the athletes you coach, you're sure to pick up tips on how to train and compete at a higher level. Today we have a special guest joining us, Dr. Dave Salo, head swim coach at the University of Southern California. Coach Salo has a PhD in exercise physiology and has been pushing the boundaries of swim training for over 30 years.
I can tell you it's always going to be fast, innovative, and unpredictable. Race pace-oriented training.
He has coached dozens of Olympians to achieve success in all events, from the shortest to the longest races, with his unique training style.
There's a lot of people are afraid to swim fast. You know, the flawed mechanics that just trained really hard a lot, that usually won out, but I don't think that's the case now. You got to train a lot smarter now.
We think it's good to be training tired and training broken down, because when the body builds itself back up, you'll swim faster. Well, yeah, duh.
Here's a good example of someone who is always asking better questions and self-admittedly doesn't have all of the answers despite his great success in the sport.
You can do a lot of things and be really successful, and I'm not that smart.
We discuss his swim coaching philosophy.
The way I tend to work is it's based on the belief system that an athlete comes to me with.
Strength training for swimming performance.
My presumption is a stronger, more flexible athlete put into the water is just going to be a better swimming athlete.
And some surprising thoughts on trends in the swimming world.
Well, I know the rave right now is the whole USRPT thing.
And here's where I kind of disagree with Brent Russell, who's leading the charge on USRPT training.
Be sure to check out all of the resources on the show notes page at RitterSP.com. There we've included links to Coach Salo's books, including his groundbreaking publication that started much of the race-paced training trend, Sprint Salo. You can find those at RitterSP.com. Once Coach Salo gets warmed up, he can really get talking, so he split this up into two episodes. Let's dive in and get Coach Salo on the phone. First off, Coach Salo, I'd like to ask, if a recruit for USC asked one of your senior swimmers to describe your training, what do you think they would say?
John, I think they'd describe it as innovative and unpredictable.
Unpredictable? Why do you say that?
Because we don't generally repeat things in practice. There's some basic tenets that I follow in terms of what I'm trying to get out of our athletes, and we're always trying to invent probably different ways to accomplish the same task. They can tell you it's always going to be fast, generally, but they can't really predict on a given day what, in fact, we're going to do. To some extent, I think they keep coming to practice to find out exactly what we might do for a given training session.
That's good. Could you describe some of those basic tenets that you have in your mind of, okay, I want to accomplish this, or how do you go about thinking that?
Well, I know the rave right now is the whole USRPT thing.
Yeah, I think you started that about 20 years ago, right?
Well, I don't know if I started it, but I was writing about shorter distances, quality training, race pace oriented training versus long over distance work. So since the 80s, mid 80s, 80, 82, I think, is when I was writing articles for Swimming World magazine. I was promoting this idea of less volume, more quality work, less focus on distance and more on shorter distances, race pace. So that kind of my basic guiding tenet for my training is, are we swimming at race pace? Are we taking the appropriate number of strokes per length? Are we holding the tempo that's going to be required to race? And so when every time I define a set, those are kind of the basic tenets I'm looking for versus just trying to get a certain number of yards into any given practice. So that's kind of the overwhelming presumption, is that we're going to do race pace, shorter distances in order to do that. And I just don't worry about how far we go in any given training session.
That makes sense. Why do you think some people are so resistant to race pace type training? I mean, there seems to be a lot of fervor still about it.
Well, I just think we're so clouded by the old adage of doing more. You got to develop the aerobic base. In order to do that, you got to do a lot of volume. And it's unfortunately in swimming, you can do that kind of training without a result in, you know, not that you're not going to have injuries, but you're not going to have the same kind of an injury effect that you do if you're trying to do that in track and field. Mm-hmm. Track and field, that running is somewhat synonymous to swimming. But as I tell people, in running, you're about 95% efficient with every foot strike. You're getting 95% of a resultant movement forward. In swimming, because of the environment, you're not planting your hand and planting something solid. You've got maybe 5 to 10% efficiency. So every time you take a stroke, you're only about 10% efficient. I don't know what those numbers are. It's just I know there's a big contrast between a foot strike and a hand catch. And so because you're not very efficient in swimming, you can go 9,000, 10,000, 12,000 yards and not be the same thing as if you were running track. You basically, if you take what we do in swimming for somebody that swims 2-minute duration races, it would be like running a marathon every day for a similar type of event. We know a runner's not going to do that. And it's contrary to what anybody would even consider doing in track and field or running. And so it's because we can in swimming, that's what's kind of led that kind of charge towards more is better. And a lot of this happened back in the 60s when I can't recall the athlete right off the hand, but it was some athletes went twice as much as anybody else. Some athletes started going double 2 or 3 times a week or whatever and had this phenomenal result at a competition. And everybody said, oh, we got to do double. We got to do a lot more yardage because so-and-so did this. So I think that's what started it. I believe that the part that's missed a lot is the neuromuscular training that's critical to performance when you're talking about rate change, tempos, and things like that. Those are neuromuscular adaptations. They have nothing to do with the cardiovascular condition. And when you're talking about swimming races, for the most part, that are 2 minutes and less in duration, the whole idea of training doubles, 9,000 per training session, those kinds of things, logic tells you that may not be necessary, let alone appropriate.
That's good. Do you think when perhaps this arms race started in yardage, how much would you attribute maybe the success to the mental side of the athlete doing more and almost being empowered by, oh, well, I'm doing double of what I used to. I have to go faster. How much do you think that played into it?
No, I just think if you listen to the arguments of coaches, they'll tell their swimmer that in training you have 2200s butterfly and at competition you only have to do one, so you're going to be better. Or you've worked harder than anybody because you've been able to do steps like that. And my side of the spectrum, it's more about, well, you've repeated race-paced swimming. You've held those kinds of times. You've held those tempos. You've done that repetitively so that you should be able to do that one swim without a lot of decay in your race. So it's each coach is going to find some way to mentally develop their athletes through one side or the other. And I think in the end run, for me, it's on repeating those types of times that you want to race at, staying good quality stroke mechanics, training their neuromuscular system to repeat those types of tempos, all the details that are afforded in swimming. I think the important part of the evolution of our sport in terms of training is that, you know, 30 years ago, you didn't have to be the best athlete. You just had to train harder. And now we've all got past that, and now you have to be not just a hard trainer, you've got to have the best mechanics. And you know, the flawed mechanics that just trained really hard a lot, that usually won out, but I don't think that's the case now. You got to train a lot smarter now.
That's good. From your perspective, have you ever seen a swimmer do, quote-unquote, too much race-paced training?
Well, I think that one important parts of coaching is not just being ruled by science. You've got to have a good amount of artistry to the whole thing. So it's that's kind of important with regards to the way I do things. It's you got to kind of gauge your athletes and decide that, well, today I'm not going to get what I want out of my athletes. I think I'd be a little bit more cognizant to just their mental state. And sometimes you got to back off the load just because you can tell that they're wore out. But by the same token, most of my athletes that we're talking about are doing one workout a day. they're not doing, you know, two workouts a day at that kind of intensity. They're doing it every 24 hours versus every they're going 6 hours apart of workouts and being that intense. So you gotta gauge it by what you see in your athletes. And I think that goes for any kind of training. You gotta be able to gauge it beyond just, well, you gotta do this. You gotta go so many yards a day. If you don't do that many yards, you're not gonna be very successful. You gotta kind of, sometimes you gotta back off because you see it in their eyes that they're not really responding, or they're bored, or you've just been repeating the same thing over again, and they just not giving you the kind of result that you want.
That's good. Why do you think there's maybe a fear to taper or let swimmers swim even in a rested state? It almost seems like there's honor in drudging through meets in season. And, oh, if you had a good in-season time, it's almost looked down upon in some ways.
No, I think that's very true. I think when I first took over at Irvine Nova Aquatics, and we were swimming pretty fast, every weekend or every meet, everybody just thought, they'll swim fast at this meet mid-season, but they won't be very fast at the end. And then they'll swim fast at the end, and then they'll just say, well, they can't do it from season to season. And then they'll do it from season to season. And then they'll go, yeah, but they can't do it every 4 years. And they go, well, and they do it every 4 years. And I just think that's just kind of erroneous thinking. I think a lot of athletes can swim pretty fast within a season. But again, I think part of way my program generally is, we've got, and I'm speaking, I've got two different kinds of programs. I have a pro program and I have my college program. My college program is primarily the two workouts that we do in a day. One's a dry land workout, and the other one that's the opposite end of the day is a swimming workout. My pros are kind of, they swim in the morning and then the afternoons. Some of them still think they need to do two workouts a day. So I just say, okay, well, you're doing two workouts a day. It's up to you. But a lot of my more successful ones are doing one swimming workout a day, and then they're doing yoga and Pilates and strength training in the weight room, that kind of stuff, at the other end of the day. And so they're separated out. They complement each other. But I think you're right. There's a lot of people are afraid to swim fast sometime in the middle of the season. And if my methodology is that you should be getting better maybe marginally every time you race, that by the end of the season, maybe you don't have this big, huge chunk of improvement, but you have a steady stream of improvement from day one to the final day of your season. I think a lot of coaches love having kids drop 3 seconds in 100 in one meet versus dropping 3 seconds on that same 100 over the course of the season. And you just get this bigger thrill. So that's part of, I think, what happens is you get caught up in the end of season big drop versus just a good seasonal drop over the course of the entire season, which I think can happen with a program that's more based on quality, if you want to use that term, versus quantity, which that always gets the blogs going, when you, the tenets of quality versus quantity training. And that's kind of what I think is about.
That's good. Going back to just consistently improving, I think a storyline of a swimmer that you coached at the tail end of his career, Peter Marshall, I think there's one instance that just goes under the radar of a lot of people. He swam with you through the end of the summer of 2009, if I remember right, and then kind of went off, did a tourist thing, hiked around a little bit, and then decided to swim at 3 World Cup meets over the course of 5 weeks. And he ended up breaking the 50 back world record 3 consecutive times over the course of 5 weeks. How are you able to train athletes to do that? And I've never heard of a swimmer doing anything remotely close to that before. And I wonder why that's not, you know, looked upon more with a little bit celebration. And how do you set someone up to swim that fast consecutively when he took a break pretty much before the meet?
Well, I think in Peter's case, part of it was that, one, he was always in good shape. He wasn't, you know, he wasn't battling 20 pounds being overweight because he took some time off. He was really relaxed and he was just having some fun. And the 50 is a technical race. There's a lot of inherent 50 speed doesn't change a lot until you've just completely gotten out of shape and you haven't been in the water. You've lost strength. And so I think a lot of his 50 backstroke was just inherent speed and all his years of of the technical things that he does so well. His rates are really strong. He's got great underwater. He's got a great start. So those weren't training swims. They weren't the results of training as much as I think all the other aspects that kind of led to that. So I think that's more inherent to that, the 50 event and a lot of skill parts to it versus training parts to it. I think if you look at, if you go back further, and Aaron Pearsall, I don't know that Aaron ever swam slower. He just seemed to always get faster and faster every time he swam practically. That he's one of those kids that just never had a plateau. And I think in it's kind of in part just the natural growth and things like that. But I think it was also that as you get marginally better from week to week, you play off of that. Your technique gets better. Your underwaters get a little bit better. You just keep getting a little bit better. And so it gives you this linear path versus breaking a kid down. If you continually and breaking somebody down, it's a nebulous term and nobody knows really what that means. And kids will throw it at me, oh, I'm broken down, whatever. I know what does that mean? You don't know what that really means, but there are some physiologic circumstances that do come with overtraining. Like you're not repleting glycogen stores in the muscle or the liver to the full extent that you could if you gave them 24 hours rest. They would replenish that. Well, if you replenish that, then each workout can be facilitated at a higher level. But coaches, most of us as coaches, we in our early training think, well, without knowing that, we think it's good to be training tired and training broken down because when the body builds itself back up, you'll swim faster. Well, yeah, duh, of course. I mean, all of a sudden, your glycogen stores are where they should be when you've rested more. You have all these, all the things that are functioning at a high level physiologically come back into real normal routine when you start resting and backing off and you start working on the speed. But my contention is do that from day one versus pounding the crap out of somebody for 6 months for one good meet in month number seven or whatever it might be, because you're just creating a physiologic system that's so, underpowered that you're not going to get much through most of the season until that very, very end. So I work more on the basis that each workout you're as good as you possibly can be, that you have glycogen repletion, you've got protein synthesis working out, that it's top capacity. Nothing's compromised by just lots of workouts. Like some coaches will go 3 workouts a day. You're bound to get broken down completely. You're probably going to get sick because your immune system is negatively impacted by intense training. And so I work more on the kind of the freshness capacity that, okay, we want you to be fresh every single workout. And you can't diminish the neuromuscular part of this whole thing. And I think going back to Peter Marshall, he had the neuromuscular training over his years of, like I said, the rates and his breakouts and his starts and all those really impactful components to a 50 meters backstroke. He had all those things intact that didn't have a heck of a lot of training requirements. It's not a cardiovascular event by any stretch. It's more of a technical event. And I liken that to a lot of alums shortly after they finish their collegiate years. They might come back a year or two later and some of the fastest 50 than they've ever done ever. And they still have some strength. They still have the technical capacity. They didn't train for it, but they might swim sometimes equally fast as they did when they were training collegiately. But I think the 50 backstroke is just kind of one of those events that, it wouldn't put a lot of credence to validating any kind of a training mechanism.
I like what you talked about recovering between training sessions. I tell people training doesn't make you better. It actually makes you worse. It's the recovery in between the training that makes you better. And like you're saying, the adaptations, restoring your glycogen and things like that. And I think that's where a lot of coaches miss the boat. Like you said, if they're going triples, when are they ever improving and recovering?
Right. And there's enough physiologic evidence for different physiologic parameters that affect performance that if you look at them, repletion of glycogen is one. That repletion of glycogen to their normal stores occurs in a 24 to 36 hour timeline. That you need 24 hours to get repletion, or upwards even as high as 36 6 hours. For protein synthesis to be at a normal capacity, it needs about a 24-hour cycle to kind of recover back to that level. And if you're interrupting that kind of cycle of recovery with another intense training session, you're going to get depletion. And when you get depletion, you get poor performance. You get poor mechanical performance because they just don't have fuel to draw upon or whatever it might be. You don't have protein synthesis that's going to give you the musculature that you need. And probably a lot of other things that go on biochemically that take place that is important to those normal processes that take place under normal circumstance. So I think you're right. That balance between training and recovery is kind of important, and we kind of neglect that. Just keep trudging on and pushing forward, and now all will be good at the end.
So I work a lot with master swimmers, and I wanted to ask you a hypothetical question. Let's say Dara Torres came to you and said, "I want to swim in the 2016 Olympics." How would you train her differently than some of your female college swimmers in the 50? Or even take it to the other extreme. What if someone like Eric Vent or Tom Dolan came to you and said, "I want to swim the mile or the 400 IM." With the age difference, how would you adjust training?
Well, I'll give you a little bit of an example more with somebody coming out of retirement, but when I was coaching Rebecca Soni until her recent retirement, she was a very traditionally trained athlete as a high school kid growing up. In her first year, even with Coach Schubert at USC, was very traditional in its moderation of training and focus of training. And I come in with this presupposition that I'm a sprint coach of some sort, and it's going to be all wrong. I had to convince her after her 2008 success in the Olympics to finish the collegiate season in 2009 and then just go to one single swimming session per day. And she kind of battled with me about that. She just felt that was just too contrary. And I said, well, if you're going to survive another 3 years going into 2012, you need to back off. You've got new demands on you. You've got sponsored demands. You've got all these different, and you've got to go places. You can't get into workouts today. It's not going to happen. You're a pro athlete now. And so she relented and got on board with that. For 2 years through 2011, swam very, very well internationally, but was just going one swimming workout a day. And it was a real, very contrary for her. And then when we proposed any changes to the preparation for 2012, the only thing that she did was decided to go two additional workouts during the week in the afternoon. So she doubled up on Tuesdays and Thursdays because she thought that would help her, that one little bit more of training that might help her finish off the race that she wanted. But in relating that story, it's about, we got some great performances out of her on one workout a day. In her mindset, those additional two workouts per week, which amounted to maybe 3 hours of additional training per week, was what she needed in her mind to finish off her 200 breaststroke and have a great 2012. If you go to a Dara Torres, you go to an Eric Vent and those guys, it would be the first evaluation is where are they in their current status fitness-wise, because you've got to determine, are we going to spend 6 months just getting you to a fitness level that allows you to train in the method that you want to train? And I would still propose the same thing with them, is analyzing the events that they're going to swim or train for. And if they're in pretty reasonable, just good physical shape, and they're taking care of themselves with regards to hydration and nutrition and rest and those types of things, then it would still be, for me, it's what's your goal time? And if this is your goal time, this is how we're going to approach the race. And it's for Dara Torres, it's going to be approaching a 50-meter freestyle race. And for Eric Vent, it'd be approaching the mile, if that's what he had his mindset on. Towards, in my mind, 14:30 is the time that you got to be training towards, and the training would be geared that way. That we wouldn't do repeat 1500s for Eric Vent any more than I would be doing necessarily straight 50s all the time with Dara Torres. We'd break it up. The 50 free is so technical. There's so many technical things that you need to work on versus training, in the sense that we got to do a lot of training to get the 50 free better. You got to do a lot of technical things. So there'd be more technical things associated with somebody doing the 50 free legged Duratores. And with an Eric Vent, there's a more training component to it, but the same premise would apply. I would do race pace with them. And for me personally, I would be thinking 1430, and I would gear his training around being a 1430. And that's just how I would approach it.
That's good. And would you give any specific considerations or adjustments based on them being much older athletes?
Well,
in terms of maybe more recovery time or certain ways of spreading out the workouts or the workload more, anything like that?
I think the way I tend to work is it's based on the belief system that an athlete comes to me with. And so it's, like I said, with Jessica Hardy, I wouldn't even suggest or recommend that she do two workouts a day. And because one, she never has done two workouts a day. She's only done one workout a day. When I started coaching her as a 15, 16 year old, she lived too far from Irvine for her to drive from Long Beach to attend two workouts a day. So she attended one workout a day. Stacyana Stitz swam for me as well during that same period of time. And Stacyana was driving from San Diego, and there was no way she could ever attend two workouts a day. So that would be that wasn't going to happen. So it's the mindset. I've had a number of kids who come into my pro program and their mindset, they don't leave that at the door. I have to kind of tell them, hey, it's okay to go one practice per day. It's got to be really intense. There's not a pattern to it. It's every day is going to be pretty intense, and you're going to need some recovery. And if I'm okay with a 24-hour recovery period for most of my athletes, it really depends on the mindset. Like I said, when Rebecca came to me before the 2012 Olympic season, it was like, I think I need these two additional workouts. Well, that's what she believes. And you need to factor that into your planning and working with that athlete that, okay, that's what they think they need to have. That's how we're going to approach it and not discount that. So I've got some kids who are very good one practice a day swimmers and have been successful. And then there's some that think they need more, and you go with that. And I caution them that, there's every workout's the same. It's not going to be different because you came this morning. The afternoon is going to be pretty intense as well. So you need to make sure that you're, again, taking care of hydration, nutrition, just your general rest, and be prepared. And then I have to kind of gauge things when I see them start to falter, that we kind of go, okay, I need to back off this practice for you or for everybody, or take a day off or whatever it might be. With my collegiates program, we've adopted a program I did several years back in preparation for 2004, where we're basically going 2.5 days on, 1 day off. And so we train, and our double sessions for the majority of our kids are a dry land session, a swimming session. We go two of those back to back, and then we do a single dry land session. So that's 2.5 days. Take 24 hours off, then we basically repeat that for 2.5 days, and then we take a day and a half off. And I did this before 2004 Olympic trials and the Olympics, and we were basically going 3 days on, 1 day off, 3 days on, 1 day off, because the basic premise behind that is I felt I could get 3 days of really intense training in, and then it would start to kind of falter off. So to avoid that, we would give them 24 hours off for complete recovery. And you come back with 3 more days of really intense swimming and take a day off versus going 6 days straight and everything just kind of gets worse and worse and worse as you get tired or broken down or bored or whatever goes on. So I felt that the 24-hour recovery is kind of a mental recovery. You feel like you're coming back on that next day going, oh, gosh, I'm ready to go again.
Yeah, my suit's dry even.
That's all for part one of this interview. Be sure to catch the rest of it as we'll explore Coach Salo's philosophy and what he disagrees with regarding the popular ultra-short race-based training theory. Find more at RitterSP.com. Subscribe to this podcast in iTunes. You can always follow us on Twitter or like us on Facebook. We'll see you next time. This program is designed to provide accurate and authoritative information with regard to the subject matter covered. This information is given with the understanding that the host, Chris Ritter, and Ritter Sports Performance are not engaged in rendering any specific healthcare or professional advice. Since the details of your situation are fact-dependent, you should additionally seek the services of a healthcare practitioner. Always check with your healthcare provider before engaging in any type of activity, beginning an exercise program, or making changes in your eating habits. Whenever you train, be sure you have proper supervision and use correct techniques to avoid injury.